White Rocket Entertainment.
White Rocket Entertainment, podcast number 278.
Theorizing that one could time travel within his own lifetime, Dr. Sam Beckett stepped into the Quantum Leap Accelerator and vanished. He awoke to find himself trapped in the past, facing mirror images that were not his own, and driven by an unknown force to change history for the better. His only guide on this journey is Al, an observer from his own time, who appears in the form of a hologram that only Sam can see and hear. And so Dr. Beckett finds himself leaping from life to life, striving to put right what once went wrong, and hoping each time that his next leap will be the leap home.
You're listening to the ESO Network, your station for all things geek.
10, 9, 8, 7, ignition sequence started. All engines are started. We have ignition. 2, 1, 0, we have a liftoff. We have a liftoff and it's lighting up the area. It's just like daylight here at Kennedy Space Center as the Saturn V is moving off the pad. It is now clear of the tower.
Welcome to the White Rocket Podcast, brought to you by White Rocket Entertainment in association with the Earth Station One Network. It's one long conversation with a variety of guests about the best of popular culture. I'm Van Allen Plexico, and this week we are once again joined by Jared Albrick. Jared, welcome back aboard the show.
Oh, hello, Van. It's a pleasure to be here. I can't wait to talk about shark fins and T-wings and just the best of open wheel racing.
Oh, no. I've booked you for the wrong show, Alan.
That was my best, Alan. That's all I got.
Oh, I hope people have been enjoying the shows I'm doing with Alan, because that's a lot of fun. But it's a very specific niche thing, so. But speaking
of... you guys do it... I know this isn't that show, but you guys do it so well that I know zero about open wheel racing, but I like listening to the show. And it just goes to prove the point. If you're enthusiastic about something... people will listen.
And you sound like you have any slight clue about what you're talking about, which kind of helps, right? I basically lean heavily on Alan most of the time. I've been watching that stuff for about a year and a half, and I'm still figuring a lot of it out. Well, we haven't gotten to do just you and me together on the show for a while, and we're doing the Babylon 5 rewatch, and we're doing the Quantum Leap rewatch, and we decided we've been kind of bouncing back and forth. So we figure this time we'll do our second Quantum Leap episode, and hopefully in the next few days down the road somewhere here, we'll finally get to go back and catch up a little bit on Babylon 5. So this episode, we're starting with Season 1, Episode 5, How the Test Was Won, and we're going to do 5, 6, 7, 8, and 9, and just go ahead and finish out the very short first season. So basically, we are covering from the middle of April of 1989 to the middle of May 1989. And I remember that time very fondly, Jared. The spring of 1989, I was living in Auburn, Alabama. I was in my junior year at Auburn, and I believe that I was living in a little brick house on Ross Avenue down to the bottom of the hill from Toomer's Corner all the way down there at the bottom with a couple other guys. And I remember that... that fall was, of course, the Alabama game in Auburn for the first time. So that was and then of course that fall was also the fall of the Berlin Wall, Tiananmen Square in China, the first Batman movie. There was a lot of stuff happening that was very eye opening during the middle and late 89. So this was a very eventful time in history. Do you? You were probably, what, 3 years away from being born at that time, or what?
No, I was 12, going on 13.
Okay.
And I was an army brat, mm-hmm. So we were living in Germany at the time. So I was there for the fall of the wall. I have a piece that I physically chipped off.
Wow.
That was pretty great. But, yeah, in the summer of 89, it's funny because, you're experiencing – I mean, you were in the middle of Batmania. And notice how I phrased that. You were in the middle of Batmania. I lived in Germany where the movies came to our Armed Forces Theater about 6 or 8 months after they showed in the States. So we only sort of were aware of Batmania. We were getting amped for it at this time. But yeah, 89, what a great year. Like you said, big political things, some really good movies. That was like Last Crusade.
That's right.
License to Kill.
Yeah.
Batman. Like, what a great year for movies. So
it was pretty impressive, yeah. We'll be talking about some of that coming up at Dragon Con this fall, which I'm looking forward to, too. And by the way, Jared and I just got to hang out for an entire weekend last weekend at Liberty Con in Chattanooga, Tennessee. And I want to thank the folks there who put on a great show and welcomed us with open arms. It was an interesting crowd, a little bit different than we usually get at comic cons or bigger cons, but it was a very welcoming and very affectionate crowd, you know, very, very into it and together. And it was just really cool to get to hang out with you and a few other good friends over the weekend.
Definitely. I had a blast.
Yeah, that was fun. So tonight we're going to talk about 5, 6, 7, 8, and 9 of season one of Quantum Leap. Now, before we get into them, here's a question I wanted to ask you, because I was looking up the list of titles just to kind of refresh myself, since it's been a couple of months since, you know, we watched them. And they have the on the Wikipedia page for the show in general, they have the season two opening narration. And I remembered this, okay? I don't want to get too far ahead, but I remembered them saying he's putting right the things that went wrong and hoping each time his next leap will be the
leap. Next leap will be the leap home.
Nowhere in any of the episodes I've seen so far has he shown the slightest interest in getting home.
Right. In season one, he's still kind of figuring out what's going on. And as I alluded to on our first episode when we did this, and I think it's important, if the listeners haven't figured out by now, if this is your first time listening, this is Van's first go-through on Quantum Leap.
Right.
Quasi. You caught them here and there.
Yeah.
You know, when they were
coming
out.
This is his
this is his first sort of plow through it, get into it. Just like on Babylon 5, it's the first go-around. So I didn't want the people out there in Radio Land to be like, is this guy insane? No. Yeah, you're right. In season one, it is Sam is just kind of figuring out what's going on. And as I mentioned in our first Quantum Leap rewatch episode, he has some pretty good reasons to go home, but he doesn't know it yet.
Okay.
So we'll catch up with that in on down the road.
Okay. So at this point, he's just like, oh, cool, I can do all this stuff and help people. Later, stuff will develop that will give an imperative to him to kind of want to wrap it up and head back, in other words.
Right. Okay. Exactly.
Well,
right now, he's just like, oh, this experiment worked, and I can help people. And it,
right.
You know, so.
Well, here's my reaction. See, I told you this the first time we did the show, was that the first episode, the first, you know, we covered the first few episodes, that they don't really do a great job after the first few episodes of explaining what's going on. They give you a little bit of narration, but and I understand to a certain degree you don't want to just step on the brakes of the narrative or the opening of the show by recapping the whole, you know, convoluted thing. But on the other hand, when I was watching it back then and hadn't seen the beginning, I had no idea. I didn't understand it at all. I didn't understand why Al was there. I didn't understand why he was intangible. I didn't understand what the little remote control thing he had was. I didn't know who Ziggy was. I didn't know what Sam was trying to do or why he wants to get home or not. None of that made any sense to me, and the little opening introduction thing didn't really tell me a whole lot other than an experiment, you know, led him to be there. So I got to say, now that I know why he's there, which is that they were doing an experiment and he sort of broke the rules by jumping in early, I don't have near as much sympathy for him as I used to, because I didn't know that. I thought he was just an innocent victim of some weird experiment. Come to find out, he did it to himself, kind of like Banner in the Hulk TV show.
Yeah, it kind of was. I mean, if I remember it correctly, and I'm sure we'll get the details as we move along, like, yeah, it was like the project was on the verge of being, like, shut down, and he was like, I know this will work, and so he just kind of,
yeah,
you know, just did it.
You know? Right. So, right.
Well, at least himself out there.
At least it didn't turn him into...
What I think is neat about it is, I think you make a good point, like, I think back in 89, especially in season one before they added any of that pre-narration... If you didn't start with episode in one and kind of follow it through, I could see where, like, especially in season one, because you got no narration, you got the barest of you'd be like, what? And in one way, that's not good marketing. But on the other hand, you're kind of experiencing it the same way he is. So, like, upon a rewatch, it's kind of really cool to think about it from that point of view.
Right.
Like, the audience is almost as confused as he is. So, it kind of works on a certain level.
Yeah, it's also interesting that the location of the show so far, this for season one, where I'm just going to be very general, the location, see if you notice a trend here and then one that's an outlier. The locations are California, Texas, Ohio, California, Texas, New York, California, New York, Alabama. There's that one episode in Alabama that kind of stands out, and we're going to talk about it tonight. So,
yeah, that's true. And I also always like to say, I like on the preamble to the show, they should say, striving to put right what once went wrong within the continental United States.
Yeah.
He very rarely leaps out of the United States.
It's not like he's going to appear in Nazi Germany at Dachau or whatever, right? Or
no,
Auschwitz.
And so. Because he can only leap within his own lifetime.
Right. That's
and
a good,
he wasn't born.
Good little set of rules to put in there to keep him from, like, meeting Jesus or Hitler or something, right? So that's...
And that's true, but I will tell you this much. I've gone on to read the novel series because I ran a few novels after it went off, and they did actually find a way to get him back to the 1700s when the United States was breaking away from England.
Oh, wow. Okay. Interesting.
That was an interesting book.
Wow. All right. Well, let's dig into him a little bit. The first up is the one that I think was probably... It probably grabbed my interest the most because I really thought it was a very clever and fun one, and that was How the Test Was Won. Now, at the end of The Right Hand of God, where he's a boxer, mm-hmm. he's, you know, raising his hand, yay, I won the boxing match or whatever, and he transforms into a farmer holding up a piglet like Babe. And you're like, oh, and he's, oh boy, right? So,
right. So
here's the thing. And we'll talk about this episode a little bit, but I got to say up front, here's the thing that I liked about this episode the most. Is it, well, there's two things. One is, this is the episode where I started figuring out that this show spared no expense getting the Babes as co-stars. I mean...
Yeah, Tess was a very attractive woman.
And they had the, what's her name, from the boxing episode that was the girlfriend or whatever, that was Mickey from, or whatever.
Yeah, Mickey from, what was that, Maid?
We Got It Made or something. Yeah,
We Got Made. That's right. Thank you.
So they and it just continues on. They do a very fine job of having local scenery. But the other thing I really liked about this episode is the whole way through the episode, Sam is trying to win the heart of this cowgirl, wealthy daughter of the big land baron guy, right? Mm-hmm. And he does about as good of a job as you possibly can. And then at the very end, in the mirror, you see that he's just really the very homely little, I mean...
He's nerdy.
He is not playing on an equal playing field. In other words, you know, you kind of, because he's the actor, Scott Bakula, you kind of look at Scott Bakula and you look at the other guy and you think, well, I mean, they're not that far different. If she's into looks, I mean, you know, she's not going to, you know, it's not like a slam dunk between the two of them. But then, because you kind of forget, at least for me, I kind of forget during the story, when you're all engrossed in the story, I kind of forget that he doesn't look like that.
That's right.
Because some episodes go to great lengths to keep showing you what he looks like where he's the African-American driver, which we'll talk about in a minute. They go to great lengths to keep reminding you he's a black man, right? He's an older black man. But this episode, they don't ever do that. They don't want you to know what he looks like. And at the very end, they're like, well, you know, you lost out to the handsome guy, but look what you had to work with. He even says something like that. And
exactly.
I was like, now that's funny. See, so what are your reactions to that? Did that affect you at all either?
Definitely. Definitely. I always like the ones where they sort of play with that, play with what he looks. And they, I mean, there's going to be so many different angles they come at that with as we watch. But yeah, in this episode in particular, I thought it was very clever that, you know, he spends this whole episode wooing the girl and going up against the real handsome cowboy, which, by the way, we mentioned that actor showed up in a Babylon 5 episode.
Yeah, that's right.
That we watched. So we've got some early crossover between our shows.
And it won't be the last.
And But yeah, I thought it was really clever because I think what they did well on the show was they engrossed you in the story and what was going on. And like you said, you kind of forget. It's not even really on your radar.
Yeah.
Anymore. And then all of a sudden, you know, at the end, Al tells him, you know, take a look in the mirror, man. Yeah. This is what you had to work with. Right. And he's kind of he's a homely, kind of nerdy looking guy. He stood no chance up against that dreamy cowboy.
Right.
And you know, if I'm jumping ahead a bit, it's one of those episodes, too, where they're fairly certain that he's out there to do a certain thing, but they are incorrect. He's not. They thought he was there to win.
Right.
Tess's heart, because everything matched up, you know, that she had letters from the lover and that, you know, he had been secretly writing letters. So they thought for sure it was him. But, you know, he wasn't the only one writing letters, as they found out.
That's one of the more fun things to me about the series is that even while the plot is going on, while the actual events are happening, a lot of the time he has to figure out what he's supposed to be doing. And sometimes it's fairly obvious and sometimes it's not. And sometimes there's a misdirection. So they do some clever things with that, too.
They do clever things with this misdirection. In fact, in this episode, we probably should have warned everybody early on. By the way, these are not spoiler-free podcasts.
No. Well, it's the show that's been around since the Cold War, so but if they hadn't seen it
by now. They did another clever piece of misdirection when Al was kind of helping Sam along when they were playing cards. And he was like, oh, he's cheating. He's dealing from the bottom of the deck. I can see him cheating. And Sam calls him out on cheating. They flip the cards over.
Mm-hmm.
And the guy actually has a terrible hand. And Sam has to apologize. He looks terrible. And Al was like, I know he was cheating. And the misdirection was, yes, he was cheating. He was cheating for the girl to win.
Yeah.
So it was another clever piece of misdirection that Al was so certain.
Yeah.
And you're like, man, you as an audience member, you totally believe him. And when you find out, wait, he was wrong. Wait, no, he was right. He was cheating, but he wasn't cheating for himself. He was cheating so the girl would win.
Very nice. So
it was clever stuff.
So this was one of the ones I liked better. I mean, you had had the different contests and you got the sense that the girl liked Sam's character in a way, but another way, she, you know, it was kind of the deck was stacked against him because nobody was taking him seriously. Nobody thought he could actually win or do any of those things. So there were just a lot of moving parts to that episode that I really enjoyed.
Yeah, it's a fun one. Lots of misdirection, lots of fun misdirection. It's one of those ones where you get to see sort of a very clever end of leap because the whole time we think he's trying to say, you know, get her to fall in love with him. When it doesn't work out, you're like, oh my gosh, is he stuck here now? What's happening? And the whole time he was there to – do you remember what he was there to do? Because I'll remind you if you don't.
Well, I guess I was thinking that he was there to get them together, get her together with the other guy. But
and what it ended up being, and that's
kind of, oh, well, there's a little kid. Like, oh, there was
together.
A,
what it ended up being was that
there was
that
a kid.
Boy.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Who was the little
Buddy.
Boy? Oh, it was Buddy Holly.
It was Buddy Holly, and he was there to give Buddy Holly kept singing that song, Piggy Sue. Oh, and then he just looked at him and said, try Peggy Sue. And then boom, he leaps.
Oh, good God.
So he was there to make sure Buddy Holly was a success.
After all that. And then there should be a later episode where he tells him, maybe you shouldn't try the airplane, you know?
Yeah, but just take the bus,
take
buddy.
Take the bus. Yeah, and while he's at it, he needs to tell that to Stevie Ray Vaughan, too. But
that's right. And Ricky Valens and the Big Bopper.
Well, yeah. Dang.
But yeah, it was a good one of those lots of misdirection in it, lots of fun misdirection in that episode.
Yeah. Well, I guess we can move on and look at the others, and then we can kind of look at the whole thing as a package at the end. So,
sure.
The next one up, and by the way, that one was directed by Ivan Dixon and written by Deborah Arakelian, who I'm not really familiar with, and that was Texas in August of 1956. The Double Identity was written actually by Donald Belisario, who's the creator of the show, and he was co-creator of Battlestar Galactica and wrote a good bit of Battlestar Galactica episodes too, which is probably why I like some of the writing on this show too. He's very involved in the writing. He wrote the first episode and the last episode and the first one of next season. So Double Identity, if I recall correctly, that's Brooklyn, New York in November of 1965. And
that's correct.
That is one where he's a gangster. He's like an Italian mafia guy, and he leaps into the body of this mafioso guy, kind of the young singing, you know, handsome guy at the wedding of somebody else, right? And he's having relations with the bride, is it, or who is it? I can't remember exactly.
Okay, he's left. I believe this is his brother's wedding.
Yeah,
and he is having relations not with the bride, but with like the grand godfather's mistress.
Okay,
she's a hairdresser in town, and she's the mistress of the head godfather.
Yeah,
and so she's on the big no-no list. But yeah, he is left in, I think, quite literally caught with his pants down.
Right.
Having just finished amorous activities in the attic, and finds himself in quite the quandary.
And he has to go down and do one of the most awkward things I've seen him do so far, although I'm sure there's many more, but this one had me squirming. He's supposed to, this is up there with him trying to fly an airplane when he doesn't know how to fly an airplane, which is he's the guy he's jumped into is a great singer, right? A great Italian singer, Frank Sinatra type. And he doesn't know how to sing. He's up there pretending to you know, try to sing these Italian.
Al had to feed him the lyrics to Volare.
He's like, Volare, yeah. Oh,
whoa.
Yeah. And everybody's just looking at him like, what is wrong with you?
Now, what's funny about that scene, I'll give you a little bit, a little peek here into the behind the scenes if you didn't know, is you notice like once he really gets into it, he does like a pretty decent job. Like once he really gets into the song.
Yeah.
And that's because Bakula does, I don't know if he still does, but I know he did a lot of Broadway work and he actually sings really well.
Okay.
I remember being a kid in about 90 or 91-ish and watching the Macy's Thanksgiving Day Parade. You know how people come down and sing songs, and Scott Bakula was on one of the floats singing a song and he did really well. So he's actually got some singing chops. So it was kind of fun to watch him act out that he was struggling and then kind of really get into it.
Well, it made me think of a question I want to ask you too, and I may be reading too much into it, but I started to wonder to myself, is it possible that since he's in the body and the mind of these other people, does he still have the knowledge and skills of those people at his disposal? He just has to kind of like let it come to him? Or are they completely asleep or out of it or whatever?
I think the best way to explain it is that when he jumps in, he's definitely in the body, and then their brains cross over, and I'm just kind of guessing here, maybe 5%. He's 95% Sam, and he might have a little glimmer of what's in their brains and their abilities. So, I mean, most of the time, it's, you know, he's kind of on his own. I think in occasional episodes, we'll see things that, if I'm not mistaken, I think he's gonna leap into the body of like a mental patient, and that's gonna be particularly difficult because the brain thing is really kind of messed up. So the brain thing is a little nebulous, but the best explanation I can say is you're looking at probably about 95% Sam mixed in with a little bit of mentally of who he leaps into.
Got it. Okay, well that's cool. So. Double Identity. So tell me about your thoughts on this one, because I like this one a pretty good bit too. And especially explain, why is it Double Identity?
Oh, well, ooh, that's a broad question. I like this one because there's a lot of humor in it. It's sort of a little cat and mouse game where, I mean, if you do a mob movie, where there's one of the hitmen is sleeping with the mistress of like the main godfather, it sounds like it'd be pretty heavy and dark. Yeah. And this one's actually a little lighthearted. There's lots of jokes, lots of funny moments. The gal who plays the hairdresser mistress is so hilariously New York.
Yeah.
It's excellent. So she was a lot of fun. And then why they call it Double Identity? Well, I know he actually leaps into two different people.
I think that's it. I was going to say, I mean, doesn't he end up in a second body before the episode is over? That was what I took from it.
Yeah, which was like the result of, and I was actually kind of surprised when I rewatched it. I kind of forgot that in this is an episode where they actually tried something to get him back. You know, the folks back at the ranch, if you will, of the experiment, where they were trying to get him back by finding some specific electrical current that would make him leap back. Didn't quite work. It made him leap into somebody else and caused the very famous New York blackout.
Yeah.
While they were at it.
Who did he end up – did he go into the – he went into the main bad guy, right? The
yes.
mobster.
Yep. The, basically the Godfather character. Yeah, he went into his body.
Yeah. Which allowed him to issue orders that would benefit the couple.
Yes. It allowed the couple to get together.
Right.
And then it was another one of those where he gets the couple together. And he's like, why haven't I leaped yet? And throughout the episode, that little old lady was trying to go to bingo. And he basically had leapt in because he had to call the bingo number so she could win.
Yeah.
And then he leapt out. Those are some of the funniest ones when there's like this huge thing going on. It is like the tiniest little thing he was
right.
there to do.
Yeah. Yeah, but I like the idea that he spends like 95% of the episode getting it to where he and that lady could be together. And
yeah,
then
they had to reenact.
And then at the very end, he then jumps into the body of the one person that could do something about it negatively, and in mm-hmm. and assuming their identity, says, yeah, it's okay with me, it's fine, they should be together, right? So you got to wonder, when he comes back, when that gangster comes back to being himself, does he know? And is he like, how dare they kill him? But boss, you said we should leave him alone.
Boss, you just told them to be together.
Are you serious? When did I say that? You're lying. I still don't know that it would stick, you know. But
let's not question it. But
but it was cute. Yeah, it was very good.
It was fun. I really liked when Al basically said, you know, in order to get you back, we got to do this and that, and plug in the hair dryer at this address, and you have to be doing exactly what you were doing when you leaped in, which was having sex with that girl,
right?
In the attic
of that place
of the Godfather's house.
Which is like, them being there the first time made perfect sense. Them going back there again, he has to contrive a reason why he wants her to go back and sleep with him again in these people's random attic, which was pretty funny. So, yeah.
It was all part of the fun.
Yeah, yeah. And by the way, we haven't really talked about it, but I got to throw out there that I realize it's supposed to be in the near future, but I'm glad that so far fashion has not gone the direction that Al seems to think it would.
Well, maybe not at your house. I dress exactly like Al at my house.
Al likes to wear like aluminum foil jackets and bright. Basically, I like that Al's near future fashion sense is, if you lived in the late 1980s and you said, how extreme could we take what we're already doing, it would look like Al.
Yes.
It doesn't. Go ahead.
I've always been of two minds about that, too, because Al's a very flamboyant character, so it's fun with him.
Yeah.
But he's also, a lot of people will forget, he's also an admiral in the Navy. And, you know, most of those guys aren't so flamboyant.
that character is supposed to be an admiral?
Yes, he is Admiral Al Calavici.
Did we know
United
that?
States Navy.
Do we? I can't remember. I guess I must
they
have
might
missed
have mentioned
that.
It. I mean, it's not a huge plot giveaway point, but yeah. I think doesn't he appear in his uniform in the opening credits, or that might start in season two?
Yeah, I don't know. If he did, I probably just thought, well, the dude wears aluminum foil jackets and stuff. Why wouldn't he wear an admiral's uniform? You know,
good point.
But it is a great point that people when people extrapolate fashion forward, they always say, what if things look like now, and then take that to the extreme. They never say, you know, in 10 years, it'll look nothing like it does now. You know, just go in a complete... Like Babylon 5, I don't know if you've noticed yet, but on Babylon 5, the way that they show that men's suits are in the future is they don't have lapels. They have, like, two little buttons up on the shoulder area, the chest area, instead of the lapels. And that's how you know that it's the 23rd century or whatever. And I'm like, no, don't just make what we have now extreme. Come up with something entirely new, because that's what they're going to do, you know. So, but anyway.
Yeah, nobody gets it like, I think everyone will point to the best representation of the future is probably Blade Runner by Ridley Scott.
Yeah.
It's the costumes are their clothes, and they, you know, they're a little different, but they're not distracting.
Right.
I think that should be every art director's on TV and movies. That should be their ultimate goal. You know,
yeah.
Just something that's different, but doesn't take away from what's going on around you.
Yeah, it's still functional. It's not like we took what we have now and just changed it a little bit so that you're like, oh, that's different. It people would be saying, what do we want clothes to look like? They wouldn't be saying, how can we change one thing so it's the future, you know? So, but anyway. Anyway. All right, so Double Identity was pretty cool. He ends up getting the young couple together. The third one up, directed by Michael Vigar. There's another Babylon 5 name. He's the director of a bunch of the good Babylon 5 episodes coming up.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Yeah. He directed The Color of Truth. And this one now, this is one I had definitely seen back in the day because this is Driving Miss Daisy. Now, I looked it up to see, and I forgot what I found out now, but it seems like it wasn't. This actually came on before the movie came out. Because I remember when the movie came out, I remember me thinking, hey, that was that Quantum Leap episode I watched. So some people are saying the movie was based on this episode. It wasn't. I think what it was that both the movie and this episode were both based on something else, and they just happened to both adapt it at the same time. Within a few months.
I'd be interested to see what studio produced Driving Miss Daisy, because I'm pretty sure that Quantum Leap was a Universal product. Yeah, I'm 100% sure it was a Universal product. Be interesting to see what studio produces Driving Miss Daisy.
Well, we can do that. We have, through the wonder of
if
modern...
If only there was some sort of electronic
thing,
information
yeah.
repository that we could tap into.
Yeah. And
are you looking it up?
I am tapping currently. Driving Miss Daisy, 1989. Oh, there's a 2014 version. She was Jewish in the movie. I didn't know that. In the movie, she was Jewish. An old Jewish woman or African-American chauffeur in the American South have a relationship that grows and improves over the years. And let's see. It was release date. Oh, it came out 26 January 1990.
All right. Full year later.
It was filmed in Atlanta, like the Marvel movies. I'm looking for the Zanuck Company... was the production company. Distributor was Warner.
Oh, okay. So not a Universal conspiracy.
No. Made $106 million. Not too bad. So
I saw it.
I don't think I've ever seen it. But
never seen Driving Miss Daisy?
Nope.
Yeah, it's pretty good.
I saw that episode.
You saw the Quantum Leap episode.
I saw the Quantum Leap episode. I didn't need to. Right? I was there. I was good. So this one was a really good one, too. This one is powerful, right? I mean, this is one of those things that... And here's an interesting thing. This is one of those things where I think where Hollywood does us a great service, because this episode has a lot of the values and sensibilities of a lot of stuff that comes out nowadays, and yet this came out in the late 80s. So I give it credit, because there it was in the late 80s making very, very powerful... commentary and statements about racism and, you know, the treatment of the elderly, as well as the treatment of minorities and everything, and just casual racism and all that kind of heavy stuff that it addresses. You know, just the idea that he wants to go in and sit down at the lunch counter to get a sandwich while he's waiting on something is this huge scandal, and the whole town erupts in chaos. You know, I know that's the way it was. It was that way probably in my hometown just a couple of years before I was born, and yet it's still so amazing. It's just so shocking to consider that that's how things were not that long ago. You know, I mean, I teach American history, and so I talk about this stuff all the time, but it's still seeing it acted out on the screen like that. You know, how did you react to it? What did you think about it?
Well, I saw it when it was relatively new. And so keep in mind, I was about 13, very formative years.
Right.
And so it was very impactful to me when I saw it. I wouldn't say super impactful. I hadn't lived. I mean, I was a military brat, so you're. It's a very diverse society I grew up in. You know, with military kids, sure. It's very diverse.
Sure.
So it wasn't like mind blowing from that point of view, but like I just never really stopped as a 13-year-old and kind of really thought about, you know, racism in the South. And I mean, I knew it was a thing, but like you said, to see it portrayed on that. On a show that I was glued to every week, it was impactful, and I love the way they did it on the show. They did it with a lot of class and respect,
yeah,
and yet they didn't pull any punches. If I'm not mistaken, they did drop the N-word a couple of times on the episode.
Maybe so. I can't remember. I should remember that. It should have.
Pretty sure they did. I think I made a mental note of that when I was rewatching it.
Yeah,
you know, and that's a dicey thing. But I think they did it with class. If you can do that with class.
Well, the way you know what I mean,
they did it appropriately. Like it fit the circumstance.
Absolutely.
And it felt like an icky, dirty word, which is the way it should feel.
Right. Absolutely. Yeah. Yeah. And I mean, seriously, I just thought. That I mean, it was an entertain. It was, you know, the first and foremost thing a show like this is supposed to do is be entertaining. Because if it's not entertaining, people aren't going to watch it, and they're not going to get the nice, you know, moral story underneath. And it was very entertaining. It was very well done. He had good character stuff between the old man and his daughter, and then the elderly lady. Who was? I guess she was supposed to be a governor's widow or something. Is that right?
Yeah, she was the governor's widow.
So she had a good bit of pull there. So I guess it was supposed to be taking place in Montgomery, if I understand correctly.
I think they might have even made up a town, but you definitely got the impression that it was, you know, maybe probably just outside of Montgomery, where, you know, she had started kind of living her quiet life, but still like you said, a lot of pull, a lot of respect. And really, it's funny because it's easy to say the story is about the struggle of Sam's character, the black man.
Yeah.
But it has a lot to do. I mean, of course, it has a lot to do with his struggle, but it has a lot to do with her.
Yeah.
Her struggle of coming to terms with what is right, what she should do.
She already knows, and she's just like so many older people, and you know who. They just don't want to rock the boat. They don't like change. They don't like radical shakeups. And so if everybody is okay with injustice, they'll just go along with it and wink and nod and just not even talk about it. You just don't talk about it. Polite society is what they'd say. This is how it is. We're not going to talk about it. Everybody just wink and look the other way, right? So what he's having to do is he's having to violate that decorum that she expects, right? In other words, he's having to go from being a cog in her peaceful life machine to being a squeaky wheel. And she doesn't like that. And she has enough, you know, love and respect for him as a dear friend and as an employee and an important part of her daily life that she gives him a whole lot of leeway, but you can still tell as that episode goes along that she's increasingly uncomfortable with it, because now she wouldn't be uncomfortable as much with it if she didn't know he was right.
But yes,
she knows he's right.
It's a precarious situation if there's no gray area.
Yeah, I mean, if he was advocating for aliens on UFOs or something, then she'd say, "You're fired. Go get help." But because she knows he's right and she cares about him, she gives him a lot of leeway, you know, and he uses it. and she has to finally confront bitter truths about herself and her society that she doesn't want to, but that she finally realizes she kind of has to. And like I say, older people like that, they don't want to have to. They want everything to just be calm and nice, and they don't want to have to think about, you know, hard reality. And it's hard for them to put aside the way things have been for how many ever, you know, 60, 70 years and change. But so I just thought that was very powerful and very effectively written and done. I thought that was very good.
That's one of my favorite things about this show is you get a bunch of fun up episodes. And I think I mentioned this on our first Quantum Leap episode, but every once in a while they'll sprinkle in what I call the poignant episode. The one that's very powerful and has a good message. And the danger zone you enter when you do those episodes is, like you said, the episode still needs to be entertaining. And you can't go so heavy hand that it's like, oh my gosh, we get it. You know, like sometimes some shows go so heavy hand on their social commentary.
Yeah.
You're just like, oh, okay, you know, back to the fun. And right. And I think the Quantum Leap family, I think as you're going to see as we go along, does these poignant episodes really well. You're going to walk away with some heavy emotion, but you're still going to be like, dang, that's a good show. I don't feel like anybody browbeat me about something, but it made me think. And that's where you want to be.
Yeah, that's exactly right. That was good. So we get a lot of good stuff out of that one. It was very evocative to me of not just Drive Miss Daisy, which I haven't seen, but I remember all around it, but also the George Wallace movie that TNT did a few years ago that I think is really good too. So good stuff there. And it was neat to be, because I don't know if our audience realized it, but you live in Alabama currently.
I do.
And I am from Alabama. I lived there for quite a long time until I moved to Atlanta and then to Illinois. So, okay, two more to go as we're zipping through the basics of the episodes. Next up was one I really enjoyed a whole lot as well. Kamikaze Kid with a C.
I love that episode.
Kamikaze Kid. And it starts with him driving a hot rod, racing somebody under the bridge or whatever. And it's out in Los Angeles in 61. I've got to think this is around the time like George Lucas would have been out there doing that, right? Is this around like the American Graffiti time? And I think
yeah, probably so.
Something like that. That's what that makes me think of. I figure Kamikaze Kid goes on to direct a great science fiction movie at some point or or something along those lines, you know. And he's the little brother of a young lady who's going to marry the another one of the... It's funny how Sam keeps being the nerdy little guy in some kind of a competition with the big studly guy. This is, in that way, this one is very similar to how the test was won.
Now I know why this show speaks to me. It's my life.
Well, it does seem like that's a recurring theme, is that he pops into the body of some little nerdy guy who's looking out for the honor of some lovely woman who's possibly with some big, studly, handsome guy who's not everything he ought to be. And in this case, the guy is claiming he's going to join the Peace Corps with her, right? And go off to, which is interesting. That must have been right after the Peace Corps was developed, because JFK rolled out the Peace Corps, and this takes place in June of 61. JFK has barely been president for 5 months at that point, but I guess he must have immediately rolled it out. I don't know. I'm not going to say this episode is wrong. I don't know for sure. And instead, the guy is actually going to like take over his dad's used car lot, and his dad is just like one of these... By the way, is there any possible, plausible way that that guy, the guy that played the dad, is remotely related to the guy that played the son? I mean... He's like a chubby.
I like to think that the son got a lot of his mother's side of genetic.
he's a fairly short, chubby, bald-headed car salesman, and his son is like, you know, the captain of the football team guy. And I'm just like, no.
Yeah, his dad is like fat J. Jonah Jameson without the charm.
Yeah. And he runs a used car lot, and he's going to take over the used car lot. And I like how the guy's wedding gift to the main lady is like a TV instead of, you know, like the one thing they really could, a big box TV like they had back then. The one thing you couldn't really take on the Peace Corps trip.
That's right.
I mean, he might as well have given her an anchor with a chain on it. If that's not a signal to her that they ain't going to the Peace Corps to Belize or Costa Rica or wherever they're supposed to be going, I don't know what he had to do, right? I mean, he basically is telling her, I'm not leaving the country. I'm not even leaving this town, you know. So Kamikaze Kid, Sam, has to... let's see, layout. What's he trying to do here? I'm trying to remember exactly.
He is actually trying... Well, this is another one where he thinks he's there to do one thing, but he's there to do another.
Right.
He thinks he's there to actually kind of get them to split up, to show his older sister that she's with the wrong guy. And this one's kind of a it's another kind of poignant episode too, because it's about domestic abuse.
Yeah,
because her boyfriend is beating her, and
yes, that's right. It did get to where he actually was. Because she pulls one of those, you know, I fell down the stairs or whatever type of things, mm-hmm. you know, later on. And you're like,
and then Sam remembers that he had a sister
yeah.
who was beaten. And worse yet, he remembers that he never did anything about it.
Right.
And so, like, and that's kind of an important theme again to the show. It's one of those things where you watch the show and you go, oh, that's a neat moment. But I'm going to tell you right now, it means something.
Okay.
It's so put a pin in that too. Well, it's almost like whatever is controlling this is giving Sam a lot of shots of redemption.
Yeah, and I was gonna say, I hope that they're building that going forward. Again, with shows like this back in the 80s, you couldn't always be sure they weren't just going to be entirely episodic and forget things from episode to episode. And I wouldn't have blamed this show for that, because every show like that, you know, every show up until the 90s was like that. But I've been hoping that when they keep throwing things out, like his girlfriend that left him, you know, what's her name? Lois from Lois and Clark. Or when his had a sister or whatever. I keep hoping that these are all building and not just, you know, one episode he's going to have a brother and another episode a different brother and another episode a cousin, you know. They just keep doing a one off on him and he's got all these relatives that, you know what I mean? I hope this is
right.
I hope they're consistent with it, is what I'm trying to say.
They will be, and I don't want to give away too much,
okay.
but I also don't want to build you up too much either. I don't know that they'll ever specifically talk about this episode again, but when we get to more of the grand wrap up and finale, you'll be able to step back and go, oh, I see.
Okay.
Unless you're like a lot of those what I call quasi Quantum Leap fans out there who complain endlessly about the last episode because they didn't understand it.
Well, I'm looking forward to seeing if
I think you'll get it, and if you don't, I'll be there to explain it to you. And everybody I've ever explained it to always goes, oh.
That's like, you know, we watched Raiders of the Lost Ark for Father's Day down here in the basement on the big screen, and that's how I was when I was told that nothing Indiana Jones does in the movie does anything to affect the outcome.
I remember when I was told that too, and I was like,
I
guess you're right.
I always knew there was something about that movie that just never quite satisfied me the way it seemed to everybody else, and now I understand why it is. You could sense it. Well, okay, so the kamikaze kid, again, let's wrap this one up. This is he drag races the dude at the end, and he basically uh-huh. provokes him to violence, right? Which shows he's a violent guy, because he wins, and the guy crashes his car, and then
trying to kill him.
Trying to kill him, yeah. And that's enough to get the sister to dump him, and that worked out pretty darn well, so.
Just a quick point out, that was one of those ones where that wasn't what caused the leap. He was actually there to fall in love with that girl, that little teenage girl.
Yeah.
Who, it's weird when you see it's Scott Bakula and like a 15-year-old girl.
Yeah.
But you have to remember he's in the body of like a 16-year-old boy.
And this is another one where when you see him, again, you don't see him very often in the mirror. Again, like in the episodes where they want you to be constantly mindful of who he is, like The Color of Truth, the Driving Miss Daisy episode, they're going to constantly remind you what he looks like. But in an episode like this, they want you to basically see Sam the whole episode, and then they're like, oh, and you look like this. It was just like how the test was won again,
yeah.
where you know, at the end, you're like, man, he's even nerdier and scrawnier than... I was surprised that cute girl at the end even liked him, because he looked so squirrely.
Hey, he was a nice guy, and nice guys sometimes finish first.
Yeah, on television, yeah.
I will backtrack a little bit, and just because I love this show doesn't mean I won't point out its flaws. The only thing about the Kamikaze Kid episode I thought was a little heavy-handed is I felt like they were trying a little too hard when they had him basically teach little Michael Jackson some dance steps.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, I saw what they were trying to do, and it was a little heavy-handed. And going back an episode to The Color of Truth, like the fact that Al shows up and talks about, oh yeah, I was in the march on Selma. I'm like,
right.
Al, you we're doing something that has to do with every episode.
Right.
You know?
He wasn't in the Martian.
Just calm down. We know Al's got a lot of experience, but he doesn't have to be everywhere
he
all the time.
He wasn't in the March on Selma, my gosh. He was two years old probably when that was going on. But when they did the thing with Michael Jackson, the thing I instantly flashed on was the scene in Back to the Future where he teaches them how to play. He Chuck Berry's cousin or whatever.
Yeah, it's right, Marvin.
It's your cousin, Marvin Berry. Yeah, like, listen to this. Like, okay, so.
Yeah, they tried a little too hard on that moment. Yeah. I watched it and I went, okay. Moving on.
Well, we got one more to go, but first I have to make sure to thank our patrons that helped keep all of our shows on the air, even this one. Whether they like it or not, even this show is helped.
We got your money now.
We got it, so, at least for this month. So you have to deal with the fact that while we do keep the wishbone, and that's probably most of the reason why we have these sponsors, these patrons, it does help keep the White Rocket shows on the air too, such as this one, an Honor Majesty's Secret Podcast, and our Babylon 5 rewatch, and just the general White Rocket show, the Avengers show, and Comics with Normies that a person close to your heart hosts, which would be you. So I want to thank our patrons. We have a new one this episode that I got to throw into the mix. So we always start out with Nicholas Cottrell, of course, our major patron, and then we welcome Chris Thrash as a new patron. Just a couple of weeks ago, we welcomed Phil Amthor, who of WeHaveDonuts.com. We have, of course, our old friends David Medinas and Mark Squire, plus Dave Powell, a guy named Jared Albrick. I don't know if you've heard of him.
That sounds like a made-up name.
I think it is. Rich Reimer, Michael Kirshner, Bill Matthews, Joey Miller, and Matthew Wagstaff, all of whom are insanely appreciated for helping the shows to pay our bills and stay on the air since we don't run like big ads. Occasionally we have like an audible.com promotion or something along that line. We did the book promotion for Lorendo for a while until everybody was sick of hearing about it, I'm sure. But basically, our patrons help us stay on the air and stay more or less commercial free, and we appreciate that.
Yes, thank you to the patrons. And patrons, if you are a patron of the show and you do love the Quantum Leap rewatch, hey, let us know, okay? Yeah. We'd love to know that.
I always forget to ask our listeners on all of our shows to give us feedback. I do on Twitter, but... Yeah, tell us what you think, right? I mean, I'm always jealous that Brandon Salee on the football show I listen to sometimes, he always makes a point at the very beginning to ask people, tell me what you like, tell me what you don't like, email us, tweet us, and we would love to hear from you. So, especially on Twitter, that's kind of our main place where the Wishbone, where the White Rocket shows congregate.
Yeah, we got some questions tonight, but we'll go into questions after we get to our last episode.
All right, yeah. So the last one is Played Against Seymour, Episode 9 from May of 1989. And this was one that has quite a few cooks in the kitchen. Donald Belisario did the original story along with Scott Shepard and Tom Blomqvist. Sound like a character from The Girl with the Dragon Tattoo. And then then there was a teleplay by Donald Belisario and Scott Shepard. So it takes up a big box on the screen here. This is one where they had kind of a theme thing running through it where it's basically Humphrey Bogart.
He even looks like it.
He's like Archer this current season, if you've been watching this crazy last recent season of Archer, where it's like he's a private detective with the partner who's dead. I mean, that's like the standard thing. That's what the Archer season was.
No, I haven't seen it yet.
Yeah, Played Against Seymour. And it's... And the other thing that I like about it is that we have yet another femme fatale, and it's Claudia Christian. It's Ivanova. Another Babylon 5 reference.
Yeah, I couldn't believe it when I saw it. I was like, holy smokes, that's the gal from Babylon 5, and I couldn't wait till you saw the episode.
This is about the time that she was in, I think it was called The Hidden. Do you remember a movie called The Hidden?
They must have hidden it pretty well because, no, I don't.
It was a movie where, from back in the late 80s, early 90s, where there was like an evil alien that came to Earth and he could like possess people's bodies. But the way that you knew that the person was the hidden was that they liked to play loud heavy metal music while they drove around looking for people to kill and eat or whatever. And so there's a scene where Claudia Christian has been possessed by the hidden. and she's like driving a convertible and blaring heavy metal and like, you know, doing her head slamming, bang, 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 bang. So this is
round. You made that up to me.
I wish I could make up something that amazing, but okay. So he appears in basically the he even kind of looks like everybody actually everybody seems to think he actually looks like Humphrey Bogart, right?
Humphrey Bogart, that's right.
Okay, so walk us through how this one plays out, because I've done plenty.
This one is, I'll go ahead and tell you, it's not one of my favorites.
Yeah,
maybe it was too many cooks in the kitchen or something, but
yeah
it's sort of a piece, like you said, it plays out. He looks like Humphrey Bogart, and it plays out like a Humphrey Bogart kind of style movie. He's a private investigator. His partner has been murdered. He's in love with his partner's wife. They've been in love while she was married to his partner. The cops think that he killed. And then to make it even like more, I don't know, confusing. Sam is starting to realize that he knows what's going to happen next because he's read it before. I think the lead, if I'm not mistaken, the lead guy, the guy who he leaped into, ends up writing a book about it. And Sam has read the book. So it's like he has these weird premonitions, but he can't remember who the killer was. He's not even sure it's not him.
That was the thing, is that he's read it. And so I remember at the beginning he was talking about how this all seems familiar. And it's because he's read it and he's like acting out a book. That was odd. Okay.
Yeah, and it was odd. And I just thought it was a real weird kind of episode to end your season on. Like, I think it would have been better just to kind of squeeze it in somewhere else and end on a poignant episode, like Kamikaze Kid or The Color of Truth. But, you know, it was probably one of those things, too, where they, you know, studio said, we'll give you 9 episodes. And, you know, well, okay, you know, and they just kind of put them together as they could.
Right.
It's not a bad episode. It's fun. It's very, you know, 1940s, very bogey flavored episode. Mm-hmm. The fun part is you know, I think they do a good job with the mystery of who the killer is.
Yeah.
On it, usually I'm pretty good at picking out the killers in those mystery episodes pretty fast. And on this one, it's a little bit tougher than most. So I tip my hat to them for that.
Yeah. And I agree though, it was an odd way to end the season because, but again, we're kind of spoiled now because TV shows really starting with Babylon 5, you know, and there were a couple that did similar things before it, but it's the first one that really tried to be an ongoing, you know, every episode, you know, building toward a big season finale with a big cliffhanger and everything. And this doesn't so much do that.
No,
it doesn't. Right. So, and what does he come back in at the end? What's our little flash hanging over to the next one?
Is this the one you've seen it more recently than me? Is this the one where he leaps into a woman at the end?
I don't remember.
I think it is.
Okay. Well, that's a good cliffhanger.
He leaps in. I think that is the redeeming quality of this episode. I watched it about a month ago.
Trying to remember.
Exactly. I'm fairly certain that at the end, you know, he does what he's there to do and he finds the killer and then he leaps out and then I believe he leaps into the body of a woman.
Now I'm going to go ahead and queue up season 2 sooner than I expected to. Good. Okay. All right. Well, all right. So there's all 9 episodes of season 1 we've done over the two episodes now. So let's look back at the whole thing. Kind of how do you rate the first season since you've seen the whole thing? Okay, and I haven't. Mm-hmm. All I have to go by is this one season. So where do you rate season 1? Like, because if this was Babylon 5, I could tell you exactly how this, you know, where I rate it compared to the others and all that. So what would you say?
Man, that is tough. You know, I've never really kind of thought of it from that angle. I'll actually be interested to see what you think of the overall first season because I'm already in love with it and it's already kind of easy in my brain to see where we're going. So I give it a lot of allowances.
Right.
But I just kind of forced into a corner to think about it right now.
Right now.
I'm going to say that it's probably the weakest season just because you're still getting, you haven't gotten some of the big puzzle pieces yet. that make it even better for me. That's shooting from the hip. I reserve the right to go back on that as we move on. We might hit a season that kind of spun its wheels a little more than others. But I think just because, you know, it's 9 episodes, it's getting the feed, it doesn't have the cool montage narration at the beginning, it's still kind of getting there. But I will say this, as far as a lot of shows, you go back and you watch their season one, it's glaringly obvious that it's season one.
Oh, yeah.
And I think Quantum Leap is one of those shows that by its own design, it's if you don't know the show's front to back and just kind of caught a random episode, you wouldn't know what season you're in.
Well, I do see that we have coming up in season two an episode set in Illinois. That's pretty cool.
There you go.
We're still jumping Ohio, New York, California, Ohio, Michigan, New York. But we
Going to Alabama when we need a racist episode.
That's right. That's right. But we do squeeze Illinois in there between New York and two California episodes. Also, interestingly, I see that the next episode, season two, episode one, is written by Belisario again and directed by Aaron Lipstadt again. This is the duo that did Double Identity.
Aha!
So the next episode could be very interesting because we like Double Identity pretty much.
With that pulled up, can you verify that this is the one where he's a woman? Do you have like the title of the episode or
anything
like that?
He doesn't give me any information just besides that I can click on. There's no... let me actually... Oh, okay. You know what? No, I can go more specifically into the season. Let me see.
I can vamp for time for you while you
Honeymoon Express, after saving a cat from a tree as a firefighter in 1957, Sam leaps into Tom McBride, played by Ron Chabadon, a New York City cop on his honeymoon.
Huh. I don't remember that. I could have sworn this was the woman episode, but whatever. Apparently it's not.
Yeah. So we'll see. But and then there's two after that are both two and three are both directed by Gilbert M. Shilton, who I believe directed, where did it go? The Right Hand of God, the boxing and the nuns episode, which was not my favorite.
Nah, it's a little bit of a wheel spinner.
I'm going to say my favorite episode from this season, with all nod to The Color of Truth as being like the most profound and important episode, I think my favorite episode of this season was, I'm having a hard time picking, but I think maybe Star-Crossed, where he was the professor and he had the girl, the crazy for him, and his girlfriend and everything. There was a lot going on in that episode. That was a busy, busy episode.
That's a good one. I could see why you'd gravitate towards it since you're a lecherous college professor.
there you go. It's the autobiographical one. Well, you know what? I'm gonna go so far. Listen to this. I'm gonna go so far as to say that more stuff happens in that 1 hour episode than happened in the entire 2 hour pilot episode.
Yeah, I will give you that.
Because it dragged.
Go back and look off the. Shooting from the hip, I'd have to say my favorite episode from season one is probably the Kamikaze Kid.
Yeah, that one's up there too, no doubt about it. I debated.
Once again, I don't want to snub The Color of Truth. It's a very poignant episode, but Kamikaze Kid also is a poignant episode about domestic abuse. And I don't know, I found it to be pretty entertaining.
The thing about The Color of Truth is it's a very powerful and well-done episode. It's just not as much fun as some of them. And it's not supposed to be.
Right. It's not supposed to be, exactly. Right.
So just in terms of fun, and I'm like, I had a lot of fun watching it. I think Star-Crossed, How the Test Was Won, I ended up liking it better than I thought I would. Double Identity, and Kamikaze Kid. I think those four are the most fun episodes, and I'll just go with Star-Crossed because the guy trying to recite poetry and then wanting to beat up Sam, and just that one was pretty fun. Although I did like How the Test Was Won a whole lot. That was with the pig doctor.
Well, I'm glad that you are enjoying it overall.
Yes, indeed. Well, any last thoughts about season one or anything we've covered tonight before we wrap up for tonight?
I will just pull up. We got a couple Twitter questions tonight.
Yeah. That's right. Yes, yes, yes.
We got exactly three Twitter questions from our good friend Kirk Spencer.
Thank you, Kirk.
Yep, Kirk is the man. He's a big supporter of what we do, be it podcast, be it my art, be it Van's writing. Kirk is an awesome guy.
We love Kirk.
And so
for that.
Kirk threw us a couple of interesting questions. He said, did you read the Innovation Comics series? Apparently Innovation Comics did some Quantum Leap. I vaguely remember this.
Vaguely, yes.
And I have not read them. I've been on a very active and very subtle campaign to get Dynamite Comics to get the rights to Quantum Leap to allow Van Allen Plexico to write them and allow me to do the cover work for those episodes. We'll see how that turns out.
Oh, Lord.
No pressure, Van.
I guess I could write Quantum Leap. It would be a very interesting stretch for me. Yeah, I'm sure. Yeah.
So you never read the comics either, Van? I want to give you the opportunity to answer.
No.
Okay. But, yeah, like me, you have a vague awareness.
Yeah, yeah.
I seem to remember seeing Quantum Leap comics. I should really seek those out. And, man, I think they'd probably do well if they went ahead and put them in like a trade. I think a lot of us leapers would come out of the woodwork and buy that.
I just remember that when this show was on and immediately after it was over, I can remember, like, at Dragon Con and places like that, I can remember there was still a very active and strong fandom for it, particularly among women. There are a lot of female fans of this show that adore it.
Yeah, I would agree with that.
Yeah,
that's why I got into it, was to meet more women.
But no, I mean there's several shows in TV history that have a very active and enduring fan base that just don't want to let a show go, and I respect that, having a few shows like that myself that I feel that way about. And, you know, it's not quite to the level of Firefly, but it wasn't far below it.
Yeah, well, don't get me started on Firefly.
Oh, gosh.
Love that show, too.
Yep.
No, I agree with you. Let's see. Kirk also asks, I guess this one's just for me, because you wouldn't know yet, Van. Did you feel betrayed by NBC when the show was canceled? So your last comment leads nicely into this. I'm going to answer that by saying, Kirk, no, I did not feel betrayed. I still think it's one of the most beautiful season finales or show finales I've ever done, even though it's often misunderstood. I'm happy to explain it to people. Just if you're going to ask me on Twitter, just ask me. Don't ask Van so he can maybe avoid any spoilers. But no, I thought it had a good run. Some shows run too long. I think this one ran perfect, although... with the premise, you could always do more.
Right.
I'm guessing you don't have any thoughts on feeling betrayed when Quantum
Leap. Well, no. I mean, it got several years. I mean, I would feel worse if it got those 9 episodes and then it was done. It would be more like Crusade, and that's one that I do have terribly bitter feelings about. So I totally, I would get it more, except it had about as good of a run as most shows have. You know, you can't ask for much more than 4 or 5 years. So.
Yeah, it definitely did not get the Firefly treatment, so there is that. And the last question that Kirk posed to the both of us, have you ever eaten a sea monkey? I'll let you take that first, man.
I had sea monkeys briefly. I just remember being very angry that they were microscopic and didn't actually look like little sea monkeys like the evil, misleading, lying art in the comic books led me to believe that they would look like. Liars.
My answer to the two, have I ever eaten sea monkey, is kind of complex. One time I got shrunk down into Sea Monkey Kingdom. I went to Sea Monkey New Delhi, and I fought Sea Monkey Kali cult members, and I ate chilled sea monkey brains.
Wow.
I went for a long walk for a chilled sea monkey brains joke with a tie-in to Temple of Doom.
That was
good. I didn't do it because it's funny. I did it for you, Kirk. So there you go. Chilled sea monkey brains was the punchline of that long walk of a joke, and I did it for Kirk.
Chilled sea monkey brains. That would be a very small dish.
It would
be tiny.
And that is it for our listener questions for Quantum Leap tonight. Thank you, Kirk.
Yes.
As always, if you see us dropping this on Twitter and you've got some Quantum Leap questions, comments, we will read them out for you because we like to know that you're involved.
Yeah, that's awesome. All right. Well, I guess we're going to wrap up for tonight. We finished out season one. So when we return, well, now we'll return to do Quantum Leap, the beginning. We'll have, Jared and I will get together at some point and decide, because there's 21, you know, there's 22 episodes for season two. So we have quite a bit more to work on for this season, and we'll figure out how many we're going to do. But when we come back next time, just Jared and me, we'll be doing the next batch of Babylon 5 episodes, because I think we've done two batches so far, right? So we'll be on to our third batch of Babylon 5.
Have we done two?
Yeah, we did.
You're right. Yeah,
we did the pilot in the first two, and then we did like 3, 4, 5, and 6. So now we're going to do like 7 through 12 or something like that. But we'll actually reconvene on, I guess, Monday night of this coming week to bring you the next episode of Under Majesty's Secret Podcast, where we do the next round of the James Bond World Cup, which should be a lot of fun.
Ooh, yeah. That'll be the last of the first rounds, if that makes sense,
I think,
right?
So. I think it may be, yeah. We'll have John Ringer back on with us to do the Bond shows with us. So, all right, Jared, well, let's wrap up for tonight. I'll go on upstairs before my wife sends out a search party, and we'll call it a night for tonight. Any last words?
No, man, just keep striving to put right what once went wrong, man.
I will do it, and hopefully one day I'll get home. All right, the Rocket's going to get out of here for another episode, and we'll see you guys down the road.
Griffin, Tranquility Base here. The Eagle has landed.
This has been a broadcast of the ESO Network, your station for all things geek. Classic, current, and beyond. Be part of the crew at ESONetwork.com.
This has been a White Rocket Entertainment production.